This morning, we return to this series that is the Bible's big story. Where underneath is the strapline, every page whispers his name. And each time we're looking at these points in the Bible, looking at the big story, each time we're asking the question, how does it lock into the big story? Because the big story is the story. Every page whispers the name of Jesus. How does it lock into the big story of Revelation, where God is saying, "Here I am"? How does it fit into the big story of rescue? Here is our Emmanuel. Here is the Christ. And we've got to the point in the Bible's big story where the people have gone into the promised land. And the Exodus is over. The land is theirs. And they are beginning to discover what it is to rely upon the grace of God. And yet, they want to be like the nations around them. They don't want to be different. They were in the promised land, and God's plan was still working. And this is how we finished last time we were in the Bible's big story, where it says this: one day he would give his people another leader and another home, but this home no one could ever take away from them. And here is the backdrop to a familiar story, to 1 Samuel chapter 16. And I'm going to use the words from Sally Lloyd-Jones' book because it summarizes it brilliantly. But this is the backdrop to the story. And I hope you're still making use both of the book or the videos, because they're incredibly helpful in stretching our thinking and shining some light into familiar passages. This is what Sally Lloyd-Jones said. God's people had a new land. Now they wanted a king. "But God is your king," Samuel told them. "He's the one who looks after you best." "We want a real king," they said, "one we can see." God knew that a king might not be kind to his people or look after them as well as he would, but the people didn't care. They wanted a king, and they wanted him now. So God gave them a king. He was called Saul. And he seemed like a good king at first, but he came proud and stopped listening to God. He didn't obey God or love God with his whole heart. "Saul can't help me with my plan," God said. "I need a king who loves me and will teach my people to love me. I need a true king." I want you to imagine this for a moment. Imagine this, that there is a throne room in the center of your will, in the center of your heart. And that bit that makes you, there is a throne that is there that someone has to sit upon. And the one who sits upon that is the one that is both worshipped and rules. Someone has to reign at the heart of you. But the question is, in this throne in your heart, at the center of your life, who is it going to be? What the Bible teaches quite clearly is that there are two kingdoms. And the question that the Bible continually asks is this: there are only two kingdoms. There are only two ways to reign. There are only two rulers. The question is, if there are two kingdoms, which one do you belong to? It is as blunt and as stark as that. Which one do you belong to? And if you want to make that really personal, whose rule are you under? There is only room for one on the throne. And what is exciting about this part in the book of Samuel is that God is on the move. That God is active, that God is speaking, that God is unfolding his plan. And yet, if you look at verse 1, it has a surprising beginning. Saul had been chosen as king, but Saul had chosen his own way, and Saul had been rejected by God. Look at what it says in verse 1. "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel. Now, this is what Samuel gets right. Samuel is right to express distress over disaster. He is right to express grief over what has happened to Saul and what has happened to the kingdom and what the effect has been of saying no to the reign of God and give us a king that makes us like the nations around us. Samuel is right over distress, over disaster. It is always right to grieve over those. Think for a moment. The waiting father, when the younger brother was away, the elder brother was delighted that he was making a shipwreck of his life. But what does the father do? He grieves over him. He grieves over him. And Samuel is right to choose distress over disaster, because the thing that Samuel understands that we still don't necessarily understand is that people are not disposable. I loved watching Friends when I grew up, and it's interesting that something that you watch growing up has now become politically incorrect for all kinds of reasons and comes with wee warnings. But I remember watching Friends growing up, but despite the fun in it, one of the things that always struck me about the Friends is that everyone around them was disposable. Everyone around them was used for their pleasure at one time or another, but as long as they had this core group, it didn't matter what happened to anyone else. And Samuel teaches us two very important things, even when somebody gets it wrong, is distress over disaster and that people aren't disposable. But God is on the move, and he comes to him and says, Samuel, it is time to move on. I'm doing a new thing. And what is the antidote to the distress that Samuel feels? The antidote is to listen to God clearly and to see God clearly. And what's remarkable, there's almost a bit of fun in this passage, because Samuel is meant to be a seer. What are seers meant to do? They're meant to see clearly. What are seers meant to do? They're meant to listen clearly. What's the one thing that Samuel seems to be struggling with all the way through the passage? To see clearly. But the antidote to living with the grief of the past, whatever failure that might be, is to listen. And to listen to what God is saying. And here's the catalyst to change in Israel. Here is the catalyst to the change in the Bible's big story, is that God is on the move and God has not given up on Israel. Remember famously, politically in America, it was three strikes and you're out. God doesn't give up with us in the same way. Look at what it says in the second half of verse 1. God says to Samuel, fill your horn with oil and go. And I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. Now the problem for Samuel is this, is that this creates a natural anxiety. In one sense, we always ought to get anxious when God is speaking. Because what we discover here in 1 Samuel is that when God speaks, it creates so many questions for Samuel. It raises our anxieties. And the problem is, and I wonder if you have had this experience, that you know that God is speaking to you. You know that God has got something to say to you. You know it because you can hear it clearly. But the problem is this, that what he is saying to you is making you anxious. Because you're aware that what he is saying to you makes you see problems. God, if I am obedient to you in this, then all I can see in my horizon is this. And Samuel's going, well, if I go and do this, this is going to bring me into conflict with Saul. And when God speaks, it not only at times makes us see problems, which are often excuses. When God speaks, he shines light on our circumstances. And if I am obedient to what I know that God is saying, it's going to disturb the status quo. How often in life do we want to just keep the status quo because that apparent peace is better than anything disturbing us? Just leave it as it is. But what happens when God is causing you to disturb the status quo in your life? That he doesn't come and say, stay as you are. And I think all of us know exactly what that is like, because we all know what it is like when God first called us to himself, when it disturbed the status quo, because it put us in the firing line. It made us different. It made us stand out. And it cost us. And think even to those moments of conversion where we say to God, God, I will follow you just as long as my life remains as it is. And everybody up to this point treats me as they always did. I don't want anything to change. But God has a perfect plan. And I love how this passage opens, because there are times when God confront Saul head on. There are times when God uses his power and his majesty. But God, forgive me, this is such a reductionist statement. There's a sneakiness about what God does. And he provides the perfect cover, the perfect camouflage. But what it does, and the anxiety that raises within Samuel, is that it gives you insight into the strife that they are living with. I cannot do this because I know it might annoy so-and-so. I cannot do this because I don't want to upset anyone. I cannot do this because it rocks the boat. And you get an insight into the stress that Samuel is living with, because he is aware that there are consequences to obedience. And you can see the anxiety that it brings. Samuel comes to Bethlehem. Did you think I'd lost the plot this morning that we sang Christmas songs? Ah, you did, some of you. Where are they? They're in Bethlehem. And Bethlehemites come out and go, do you come peaceably? Or is it going to kick off? Because we know that Saul has been rejected by God. We know that you're a man of God. Do you come peaceably? Or are you going to disturb the status quo? Do you realize that the moment that anyone is converted, they disturb the status quo for those around them? A new king is there. And look at the anxiety that it raises. And here is a place to remember. Look at where it begins. Look at where Samuel is looking for a king. Where is he looking for a king who's going to disturb the status quo? He's looking for a king in Bethlehem. And here's the joy of the passage. God is on the move. And it's about God's sovereign choice. But here's the challenge of the passage. Because there are two kingdoms, there's a conflict, and there's always a cost. When Nehemiah came back to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, there was a whole pile of people who said, just leave them as they are. Don't change anything. Don't disturb the status quo, or people will get annoyed. The Sanballats and Tobias will come, and it will create conflict. Here's the thing. Peacefulness is not evidence of people being at peace. Quietness is not evidence that all is well. And stillness is not evidence of justice. Actually, these things can be evidence of oppression and silenced voices. Do you think that in Iran, as hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets, that that's evidence of turmoil, or is it a reflection of what was always there but kept under wraps? Peace is not quietness. But actually what you can discover is that quietness can shout loudest that something is wrong. But the big point that is made here is that here is God's perfect plan. Here is the king that is chosen by God, and a heart is revealed. Why does Samuel make the same mistake as the past? When Saul was chosen, listen to how Saul was chosen. 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 2 says this, "And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upwards, he was taller than all of the people." That's the king that we want. That's the king that we need. That's the king that the other nations will go. Their king is the best looking king. And he's taller than everyone. But where is stature found? Stature is never found in height, but always in humility. I remember meeting one of my spiritual heroes who I'd only ever heard online. And what surprised me most of all was how small he was. And I said to my dad, I said, "I met so-and-so," and he said, "He's quite wee." I've listened to him for years, but I thought he would be this giant of a man. And he said, "No, that's just the stature of the man." And what Samuel struggled to see was what God looked for. And here's the question. In these verses, whose heart is being described? Is it Samuel's heart? Is it Saul's heart? Is it God's heart? Let me ask you a question. And that person who reigns in the throne room of your heart, what do we look for in the kings that we make for ourselves? Isn't it those that we think will make us look good? Isn't it those that we think will make us feel good? What do we wrap our identity up in? The very things that the world says, this is what matters. What is it that shapes our choices? Who do you want to be seen standing with? And before Samuel is brought a parade of sons. And here's what is lovely about this passage. Because let me say to you this first of all, the passage is not about you. The passage does not say that there's anything wrong with being tall. Pete Berry, you're all right. You're okay. Kenny, you're all right. So you don't go to this passage and go, "I am tall." Somehow the Bible is saying that I am lesser. But unfortunately, me and you, Duncan, have this in common, that it does not say there is a virtue in being small. It's not saying that. It's not about you. How is David described? He is not described as a small, ugly, hunchbacked man who is bald. Do you know you're not allowed to slag people for their baldness now? Because that's a gender-specific hate crime. Just stick that in your pipes. How is David actually described? He's described in the Bible as the kind of man who draws people to himself. Look at what he says in verse 12. "And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and he was handsome." Isn't that wee bit in you goes, "I hate him"? He's not, God doesn't come and say, "Look, here's something beautiful and here's someone really ugly." He's not saying that at all. It's to miss the point. And it's not a passage where you come and say, "Well, I'm small and I'm ugly and I'm bald. I'm all right." It's not about that. And if you've just looked to your small, balding husband, just remember, you were their choice. It's not about you. It's not even about that. It is part of the unfolding story. It is part of the big story. Because here is the language that's being used. The first thing is that there is a language of choice. This is a delight in God's surprises. He chooses the youngest son. This is a language of election. It is all about God's sovereignty. It is about the language of call. It's about delight in God's wisdom. What is one of the most underrated gifts in the world? What is one of the most underrated gifts in the church? What is one of the most underrated gifts for the Christian? Discernment. What is right? Helping me to see what you see, God. Helping me to want what you want, God. Help me to hear what you are saying, God. What is it that makes David a better king? It's that God chose him. And here's the thing. It's all about the glimpse of the true king. Everything in this passage has the fragrance of Jesus. Because one day, there will be others looking for a king in Bethlehem. And they're looking for the true king. Listen to what it says about David in Psalm 78 in verse 70. It says this: He chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob his people, Israel his inheritance. With upright heart he shepherded them and guided them with skillful hands. But it's a glimpse of someone more. Listen to what it says in Isaiah chapter 53. It says this: Who has believed what he has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him. I'm going to stop. Here's a little aside. We are desperate to create images of Jesus, aren't we? Is that Jesus? Is Jesus white? But we are desperate to create an image of Jesus that is in our image. But listen to what it says. He was despised. In fact, did you know that most of the Victorian pictures of Jesus in stained glass windows are based on Alexander the Great? Listen to what it says. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And here is what the passage does. It takes you back to the beginning and a choice to make, where the question is, are you seeing clearly? Are you hearing clearly? And the choice that you have to make about who reigns on that throne is a choice that confronts you. There is nothing harder in all of life than to be a Christian, because there is nothing more humbling, because it says, Jesus, take the throne room. But do you know what has to happen before that? You have to get out of it. You have to die to self. You have to give it over to him. It's a choice that challenges us. It's going to make you different. It's going to make you stand out. It's going to cost. And yet the question is this: how can you say no to the king? How can you say no to the servant king? How can you say no to the true king? Listen to how Sally Lloyd finishes She says, once again, God would say, go to Bethlehem. You'll find a new king there. And there one starry night in Bethlehem, you'll find a new king there in the town of David. What field did the shepherds shepherd in? The very fields that David shepherded in. And three wise men would find him. And some shepherds would worship him. So it is not a passage that is intended to make you feel better about yourself and going, I'm not tall enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not beautiful enough, but yet God loves me. All those things are true. It's asking a bigger question. Which king reigns? Who rules in here? Who's calling the shots? Christmas is past. Post-Christmas. Who reigns? Who rules? Who's sovereign? Jesus is not just for Christmas. He's the King. And so let me ask you, post-Christmas, what King is reigning here?